Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a community of entrepreneurs, freelancers, and remote workers who believe that life is better when you work together. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Find your tribe.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. There is a certain kind of deer that gets a whole lot of press this time of year, but this hour we're going to talk about deer and other hooved animals that are native to the state of Iowa, and wildlife biologist Jim Pease is here to educate us this hour. Hello, Jim.
Hello, Charity. How are you this morning?
Wonderful. Thank you so much for being here today.
And you're in the holiday spirit, aren't
you? I am, absolutely.
Right. Very good, very good. I came with bells on this morning.
Of course you did. So this time of year, in Iowa, we see a lot of white-tailed deer. White-tailed deer, I guess maybe we see them a lot all year round. But I want to start back in time because white-tailed deer were not something that Iowans saw a lot of even just a few decades ago.
Well, yeah. Actually, the original Iowans that were here, the Native Americans, prior to the coming of Euro-Americans to this part of the country, those Native Iowans saw lots and lots of deer. Deer were, white-tailed deer we're talking about here, were abundant in Iowa. So, too, were two other ungulates. Two other ungulates that...
And let's define ungulates.
Yeah, ungulate are hooved animals, okay? These are the animals that walk on their toenails. You know, that's what hooves are. They're basically toenails. Their feet are made a little different than ours are, but if you can imagine yourself walking on your toenails, that's what all of the hooved animals do, and that includes the even-toed ungulates, which are the artiodactyls, which you could use that certainly in a crossword.
Sure. Right? A crossword and a final test.
That's
really
right.
Nowhere else.
That's right. You can impress people at holiday parties with your knowledge. So it includes deer and moose and all the antelope, including all the antelopes on the African savannas. Camels includes hippopotami, bison, pigs and peccaries, sheep, goats, let me think, muskox, cows, giraffes even. All of those are even-toed ungulates, meaning that they have their hooves, their toenails. They're walking on the toenails of two toes in their front and back feet. But then you've got this small group of odd-toed, the perissodactyls, which include horses, which have one toe on each foot that they're walking on, that hoof. The rhinoceroses, which have three toes on each foot. And then a critter that I just recently saw in the Pantanal of Brazil with a group that I took down there, the tapirs. And they have four toes on the front and three on the back. So they're odd-toed on the back.
All right. So our ungulate education is
right
now
now almost complete. Right.
So tell me about the other ungulates that lived in Iowa.
Well, bison were certainly one of them, and they were very, very numerous. In fact, there are some estimates that think that they numbered in the area of 60 million. 60 million animals. It's hard to believe, isn't it?
And they're such enormous animals that the number 60 million is so enormous, but then think about the size of the animal that we're talking
about. Yeah, exactly. And almost all of these ungulates are very large animals, except for a few of the dik-dik antelopes in Africa, which are about the size of a chihuahua. But most of them are very, very large critters and herbivorous, mainly plant-eating in this bunch. And these plant eaters, these bison, 60 million of them, it's a huge amount of biomass, but they were primarily on the Great Plains. More of them, many, many more, were present across the Great Plains in states to our west, from the Dakotas down through and actually up into Canada, into the prairie provinces of Canada and Saskatchewan, Manitoba, and portions of both Alberta and Western Ontario. So there were bison all the way down into to Mexico, northern Mexico as well, in that Great Plain region. 60 million of them. It's just amazing. And in Iowa, we certainly had some, but they were not nearly as numerous as another even-toed ungulate that we had here, and that's elk. Elk were more common in Iowa, according to all of the sort of historical accounts that we can find, and Jim Dinsmore did this in a book called A Country So Full of Game some years ago back in the 90s. Wonderful, wonderful book. And he searched lots of historical documents, and really elk were more common than bison were, especially in the eastern half of Iowa, which makes a lot of sense because that tends to be where our woodlands, what woodlands we have, and certainly the savannas were more common in the eastern half of the state than in the western half of the state. And elk, bison are primarily grazers, eating the grasses and herbs of the prairies, whereas elk tend to be both grazers and browsers, where they'll eat a lot of the woody plants as well. So it makes sense that elk would be much more common. But they were still prairie animals. Elk before Europeans came to this country, to this continent, elk were spread virtually across the country in every state except the deep south and maybe the Atlantic coast. Really were very common in Iowa. We think of them today as a sort of Rocky Mountain species,
right.
You know.
They're Western creatures.
Yeah, but they were here. They were here, and they were more common. Not as common as white-tailed deer, but they were probably more common, at least from the historical accounts, than bison were.
Fascinating. Well, and of course, we still have elk in the state, although they're entirely fenced in.
Right. Right.
And
yes,
we have
are.
Some bison in the state. They're
bison,
also fenced
all
in.
Fenced in. And as a result, you know, if you look at restoration of various critters, you think, gee, could we ever get elk back? Could we ever get... There are some elk restoration programs going on in Michigan and some in Missouri and... a couple of other states.
Yeah, and even
trying,
in the lower peninsula of Michigan, not just in the upper peninsula.
Not in the UP, right. So it's possible that we could see them back in the Midwest.
What kind of habitat do they need? What, because, of course, as we know, Iowa is an altered state.
Yeah, right.
So what kind of habitat do they need? What could we do that could possibly make this place they could live?
They need large chunks of a mix of habitat that includes both prairie and woodland. And they use them differently at different times of year, but certainly they were prairie critters as much as they were woodland critters. And so a mix of those two species. But the key thing is they need very large chunks of land. And we simply, Iowa being a state that has something around only 2% of its land in public ownership and very little of it, even if you include protected private land, we don't have large chunks of that kind of habitat that is not fenced and all those things that wild critters, to be truly wild, need. So I think it's unlikely that we'll ever have them back in the state.
All right, well, let's talk about white-tailed deer and how they fit into that picture. Because if we had elk and we had bison, white-tailed deer would be competing for the same resources?
Well, similar resources, yeah. Whitetails certainly occupied the same habitats as elk did. Elk were much fewer in density because they're much larger, and elk disappeared much more quickly than just about anything else because they were big, they provided lots of meat, and they were delicious. So so they were very subject to being slaughtered. And I use the term deliberately because that's in fact what it was like in the 1800s when our ancestors came to the state. They came basically to build railroads, to pioneer, to homestead land, and all of those they couldn't run in any of those occupations at the time. They couldn't run to the grocery store to buy groceries. Instead, they used what was available to them. So all throughout the 16, 17, and 1800s, and even into the 1900s, people took wild animals, as many as they wanted, whenever they wanted, and whatever they wanted. So bison disappeared from the state of Iowa by 1870 at the very latest. Most of them disappeared much earlier than that. Elk were not far behind. By the late 1870s, they were gone from the state of Iowa. And white-tailed deer were gone from the state of Iowa by the turn into the 20th century. By 1900, basically, there were no deer left in the state of Iowa. That's hard to believe today. And when we looked at those herds of bison and those herds of elk, nobody thought they would ever be wiped out. But when you have human greed as a factor and no legislation or no legislation that was, there were laws that tried to protect deer as the populations were disappearing that were passed anywhere from the 1860s on, but they were never enforced or rarely enforced. And so people basically took what they wanted whenever they wanted, as many as they wanted, and whatever age they wanted. And so populations of bison and elk and deer were gone from Iowa by the end of the 19th century.
And we also know, of course, if you've paid any attention to looking at historical photos and,
right.
you know, the history of the railroad, we know that a lot of these animals were slaughtered and not consumed for meat.
Right.
There was an idea that there was no way that we could ever run out.
Right, right. In fact, they shipped trainloads of bison hides back to the East Coast for leather, for buffalo robes, all those sorts of things. The bones were used. We reduced humans, our ancestors reduced the population of bison from somewhere around 60 million. Some would say, oh, it was only 50 million. Okay, whatever. Down to fewer than 1,000 animals that survived. That's remarkable.
It is. We are going to take a short break, and we'll be back in just a moment. We are going to talk more about the hooved animals that do or did call Iowa home. With me this hour, wildlife biologist Jim Pease, and you are welcome to join the conversation as well. Give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a community of entrepreneurs, freelancers, and remote workers who believe that life is better when you work together. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Find your tribe.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Wildlife biologist Jim Pease is here with me this hour, and we're talking about hooved animals that have called Iowa home or call Iowa home now. And, of course, we'd love to have you join our conversation. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We've been talking about bison and elk, both native to the state of Iowa, although they do not live in the wild here now. And Paul is on the line from Ames. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Journey.
Hi, what would you like to talk about?
I just heard Jim talking, and I spent last summer in Canada and Alaska. The first time I saw a map of the bison range, and it just was unbelievable. Like Jim said, they ranged from Alaska to Mexico, from almost to the East Coast to the Rocky Mountains. And, of course, Canada has wood bison,
right.
which were discovered not too long ago. They were thought to be extinct, so they're reintroducing them. And something I learned from a native man in Canada was when an elk lays his antlers back, they lay down right along the side of his body. And he said, you know, this is not a woodland animal. This is an open range animal. You know, a moose or an elk doesn't do well in heavier forest. And he said,
timber.
Essentially, our hunting pressure has driven them into the mountains where they're safer from human beings. So, great show. Thanks, Jim.
You bet. Thanks for the call, Paul. Yeah, in fact, that's what I said, this mix of habitat between woodland and prairie. So you've got that savanna. In fact, I think elk, if you look at the evidence, just the modern day evidence, I think elk were responsible not just for the maintenance of what we call savannas, which is that open parkland underneath sort of open grown trees that have large lower branches, but there's not a lot of brush or anything underneath. It's much more of a grasses and herbs underneath than there are woody plants. And a lot of people have tried to recreate or restore savannas and have had and tried to use the tool that we have tended to use a lot in prairie management, which is fire. I tried to use just fire, and they have a heck of a time controlling the woodies. They have to go in and clip them by hand or use herbicides on them. And elk did that for free. And
and they liked it.
They liked it, exactly. So I think savannas were not only maintained by elk. If you're this dark beast out in the hot summer sun, you're going to head for those trees in July and August, you know, and while you're there, you eat and you create these savanna environments. So I think they didn't just maintain them, but they helped create the whole idea of savannas. In paddling Iowa rivers, I've noticed in some of our rivers, there are really some nice savannas on the hills surrounding or on the banks surrounding the rivers and the upland sites. And those tend to be maintained by cattle. Cattle are not as good at it because they're more grazers than they are browsers eating the woody stuff. But elk eat a lot of the woody stuff as well. And so I think they really helped create savannas. And just looking at the modern maintenance of those prairie areas led me to believe that.
Yeah, well, and we've in shows we've done in the past that have focused on bison in the United States, we've talked a lot about how they shaped the landscape. And that it's very interesting because we think about providing habitat for animals, but we don't necessarily think about how those animals impact the habitat. I mean, we talked about it with wolves earlier this year and
right.
and beavers, they really remake or maintain the landscape.
Right. Oh yeah, exactly. And they do shape it and maintain it. And certainly deer have done that and elk and bison did that in Iowa. In fact, there were buffalo wallows, still can be found in a couple of places in Iowa, sort of remnants of them. So much of the landscape has been reshaped, though it's hard to tell where they were. But there were some extant into the mid-1900s, by 1950s, a lot of the buffalo wallows. And some of these wallows were huge, covering, you know, several acres of land. So these bison would come in and lay around and roll over and scratch and spar with one another. So these wallows, they would roll around in them probably to remove insects and parasites and ticks from their back, as well as to scratch their backs, you know, whatever. So, yeah. So it was those things were excellent on the landscape until in the 1950s, but there's been so much reshaping, I think, of the Iowa landscape since then. We don't find them very much.
Ralph is on the line in Grinnell with a question about another ungulate. Hi, Ralph.
Ralph is on the line.
Ralph, are you there, sir?
Hi there.
Hi.
Speaking of the buffalo wallows, I don't know whether there's one right south of Belle Plaine on the west side of the road going on 21 or not, but there's always a lot of ducks and geese there in the fall. So what I wanted to ask you was about mule deer. Do they come east to the Mississippi, or do they stay west of Mississippi?
Yeah, they're primarily a western species. And it's interesting. Mule deer are something that a lot of biologists are really concerned about because whitetails tend to be somehow more adaptable, more almost invasive. And there are places... It's hard to tell whether it's that they're more aggressive than mule deer are, or that the habitat is changing to such. But there's a concern that mule deer are losing ground and whitetail are expanding. So mule deer are primarily western species, and whitetails are more eastern and central U.S., so east of the Rockies.
All right, well, let's talk about white-tailed deer. As you said, they were here in Iowa. They shared the space with bison and elk, but all of those animals were extirpated from the state.
Right.
They were hunted until they disappeared. How did white-tailed deer come back?
Yeah, that's a great question. A number of things happened. Once they were removed, they got, and again, this was by 1900, there were no white-tailed deer left in Iowa. There were some that certainly migrated in from surrounding states where they weren't extirpated from. Probably Missouri, a certain extent, Minnesota, Wisconsin, possibly the Nebraska and the Dakotas. So there'd be some that would wander in. There were certainly some releases. There were some folks who tried to raise deer, and they escaped from captivity. So those kinds of things happen. And there were some deliberate people brought them in from other states in order to repopulate certain parts of it. So there was some deliberate. But it was really the change in laws and the impact of enforcement of those laws.
And a growing understanding of biology and how that works, right?
Yeah, certainly. There was some of that. Certainly, you know, some of the big hunters at the turn of the century, Teddy Roosevelt was a big game hunter, and he realized that we were losing these populations of animals that he loved to hunt, and realized that he needed to change the laws and change the ways that land was being managed in order to protect some areas for other species that we share this earth with. And so there were some laws that were passed in the late 1800s, early 1900s, but they really weren't enforced until the beginning of the 1930s. An Iowan by the name of Ding Darling went to Washington, D.C., in the FDR, the Franklin Roosevelt administration, and he sent the first federal marshals back to the Midwest to enforce some of the game laws, particularly for interstate commerce. He was talking about migratory bird laws that had been on the books since 1901. It's amazing. So there's a whole generation, these laws, or two generations, these laws were on the books, but they really weren't enforced until about the 1930s, and then enforcement got serious. And there's this change in attitude with disappearance. There were certainly more laws, and then finally they were enforced. And people began to see that it's necessary, in order to bring deer back, it's necessary to have protection for a while until the populations build to a point where they can be used again through hunting. And our first modern deer season in Iowa was in my lifetime, began in 1953. That's half a century ago. and so we've really only had deer hunting in Iowa, modern deer hunting as we know it, since 1953. And the population had built up over half a century from about 1900 up through the early 1950s to where they thought that we could actually take some deer through hunting, through controlled hunting. And they did that in 1953, harvested about 4,000 animals. Today we harvest in Iowa over 100,000 animals every year. And it's remarkable, that kind of recovery, when you think about it. It says something about the animal and how adaptable they are. Deer tend to like the changes. If we give them half a chance, if we control both the size, the numbers that you take, in some cases, the early laws were buck-only laws, so you could only take the males. So they allowed the species to propagate. It didn't take the does. Today, we harvest both bucks and does. In fact, in Iowa, it's about 50-50, which is pretty amazing when you think about it. And does will continue to contribute to the population then each year.
So let's talk about, they obviously don't have the elk and bison competing for
right.
the same kind of habitat. deer seem to thrive everywhere. What kind of habitat do they favor?
Yeah. They're certainly a woodland edge species, and but they wandered out onto the prairies as well. So they do very, very well. They've adapted. Deer, white-tailed deer, eat over 350 different species of plants that we know of. That's a pretty broad appetite, if you will, taste for food. So these are herbivores, large herbivores, and they'll eat about 2 to 2.5% of their body weight every day in vegetation. And that means that they have to, that's a fair bit for, you're talking a 90 to 150 pound animal on average, depending on buck or doe and age and everything. So you're talking a lot of food every day, and that's the dry matter basis, not the wet. So you're talking several pounds of vegetation on a daily basis just to maintain that. So they're eating so many different species of plants. They're generalists, so they can do pretty well, and the changes we humans have brought to the landscape, particularly in terms of agriculture, they've adapted very well to eating corn and soybeans. That's pretty amazing.
Well, and when you say woodland edge creatures, I think about how we shape our personal landscapes, our yards. We're creating a woodland edge everywhere we possibly can.
Absolutely. We tend to do that. Those fence rows, those certainly where fence rows have been removed on the agricultural side of things, deer and other species have lost out, because that habitat, that edge habitat, was really valuable for all kinds of species, not just deer. But as we've gotten larger and larger fields and removed those fence rows and don't have livestock anymore, there's less and less habitat available. So they tend to crowd it into those areas that are left. And it includes urban areas. Urban deer management is now a huge field within wildlife management. And you couldn't have convinced me 50 years ago or 30 years ago that urban deer management would be a huge problem, but it is. And we tried to keep deer in the urban areas and other areas, somewhere in the neighborhood of under 30 deer a square mile. And if we can achieve that, but in many of our urban areas, there are much higher populations of that. And so they've turned to all sorts of ways to try to manage that population.
Well, and what else helps them to thrive with, they don't have competitors with other ungulates? Is it also lack of predator pressure other than human predators?
Absolutely. And that's one of the other reasons they came back so quickly, relatively quickly in Iowa, is the removal of all the large predators. We basically removed the wolves and the mountain lions from the landscape. And deer have are very productive. Okay, they 1-year-old does in Iowa will have a fawn their first year. At 1 year's 1 year of age, they'll have a fawn. So they're and older does will most commonly have twins, and a small percentage, probably 8 to 12% of them, tend to have triplets in Iowa. So this is a very productive landscape. The deer reflect that, and so they're very, very fertile and have large numbers. Without hunting, deer deer populations can grow 20 to 30% annually in an area. So without hunting, that would be a very rapid increase in the state. And hunting includes hunting not just by humans, but by other large predators, including wolves and mountain lions. And when those aren't around, they do very well.
Right, and we don't have wolves and we don't have mountain lions, at least not very often,
right.
In the state of Iowa. And coyotes don't tend to take white-tailed deer?
Well, they will take fawns if they can. And coyotes hunt differently than wolves do. Coyotes tend to be more solo hunters rather than pack hunters. And so the taking down a full-grown deer is just out of the question. And so they might take some fawns. They certainly do take some fawns.
But they like rodents and
right,
things like
exactly.
that a lot more.
Rodents and rabbits and, yeah, exactly.
And they'll eat a deer if they find it.
Sure.
A dead deer, for sure.
You bet. You bet. They're
right,
great scavengers.
Right, absolutely. We see a lot of critters feeding on dead deer along the roadways in Iowa. All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. We're talking about ungulates this hour, hooved creatures that have been native to Iowa. And, of course, right now we're talking about white-tailed deer, which are omnipresent in our state these days. We'll continue our conversation in a moment, and you are welcome to join. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me today, wildlife biologist Jim Pease. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about hooved creatures that have lived in Iowa and live in Iowa now. We're focusing at the moment on white-tailed deer. Wildlife biologist Jim Pease is here with me right now, and we've been talking about how white-tailed deer have come back to Iowa and thrived in the state due to a lack of predation, a great habitat for white-tailed deer. And we have a question, Jim, from Nathan. He says, is it true that the deer harvest numbers are controlled by the State House instead of by DNR wildlife biologists?
Yeah, this is a real... It's a problem not only in Iowa, but it's a problem increasingly in states in recent years. Certainly, nominally, the DNR, the Departments of Natural Resources in Iowa and Wisconsin, Minnesota, et cetera, control what gets harvested and when and how. But that is certainly, those policies are increasingly, I don't know if it's increasingly, I think it is increasingly, influenced by political whims of people in power in various political offices. For example, Terry Branstad, in his most recent administration, I think politicized the DNR to the point where it was... It caused Ding Darling, who was one of the originators of the Iowa Conservation Commission, to literally roll over in his grave, I think, because he wanted to remove natural resource management in his wisdom. I think he wanted to remove natural resource management at least one step from politics. So for many, many years, for decades, in fact, the until 1986, all of the Iowa Conservation, then Iowa Conservation Commission, the forerunner of the Iowa DNR, was appointed, the head of the agency was appointed by these group of volunteers, the commissioners, not by the governor. In 1986, that all changed. And for several administrations, they maintained having a professional in that role as totally removed from politics. But it began during a previous Branstad administration, where they put some of their political friends into the DNR to kind of watchdog it. And then eventually, this last administration, Branstad actually politicized the DNR so that all employees down to the bureau level are at-will employees. It's not to say they're not professionals. They certainly are. But it means that they are there at the whim of the governor. I think that's a huge mistake. Ding Darling thought that was a huge mistake. And it means that issues, be they white-tailed deer harvest, inspections of enforcement of various laws that are on the books, all of that can become very political. So while the State House doesn't determine the harvest, they certainly have influenced a number of things. It hasn't just happened here. In Wisconsin, for example, because of chronic wasting disease, the DNR outlawed outlawed the feeding of deer, a baiting of deer in the wild. And all across, particularly northern Wisconsin, there was a hue and cry from feed mills that made lots of money selling deer food. And so the legislature changed it. And that kind of politicization of natural resource management, well, it's always been here, I suppose, to some extent, has become worse in the last couple of decades. And we need to, I think, as a public, need to realize that natural resource management is not a political issue, shouldn't be a political issue, at least. And we need to wrest control of that and put it back in the hands of professionals. That's my opinion.
All right. It sounds like something we should explore further. There are clearly other viewpoints to be shared as well. But the upshot is that not necessarily the management is not necessarily being determined entirely by biology and science.
Right.
There are other factors in play as well. Let's go to the phone. Bob is on the road right now. Hi, Bob.
Hey, how are you? I'm going to ask a few questions and I'll just take my call on the radio.
All right.
But wonderful program. I driving through Iowa on occasion, just great. But a couple questions I got. I had heard that deer, white-tailed deer, are not eat genetically modified corn. And I'm a hunter who is out of Illinois, and I'm lucky enough to hunt throughout the Midwest. And I had heard about there being no deer in the state of Illinois or Iowa, but the Chicago Athletic Club in the turn of the century, more or less, more like a zoo, went to Alberta, northern Michigan, and brought in all these deer to more or less start hunting in some of these areas. And to tell you the truth, when I'm out hunting, you can kind of notice really differences and likes and non-likes of different types of deer. Like in some parts of Illinois, you can find the spindly racks from northern Michigan, or you can see the deer with the huge antlers that are basically from Alberta. And we had always heard this, and we'd talk about it about a little bit, but just wonder what your thoughts were on that. I know you covered it a little bit, but
yeah.
I greatly appreciate your help. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks a lot for your call, Bob. Okay, let's tackle that first one first.
Yeah.
GMO corn and deer?
No, they eat it just fine. They don't notice a difference, whether it has any impact long-term or short-term. No one to date has noticed any, but no, they will eat GMO corn just like they eat other corn if they give a chance.
Right, and corn is not a great source of nutrition for them. I mean, they eat corn, but they prefer leafy greens, right?
Yeah, yeah. What happens is that the deer, like a lot of ungulates, like vast majority of ungulates, are herbivores, and most of the herbivores in the ungulates anyway are ruminants. Ruminants means that they have an extra stomach, if you will. It's a ruminating chamber that's filled with bacteria. Bacteria change from summer to winter. In fact, many deer, many ungulates don't survive that changeover from one food type to another because the bacteria in their stomach, for one reason or another, don't change. So they may be able, the bacteria that digest the leafy greens, the herbaceous stuff in the summer, are different than the bacteria that can digest the woody vegetation high in lignans and other things in the winter. And if they can't make that change, they starve to death. They can starve to death with a full stomach. It's one of the reasons there's been lots of controversy over the years about whether we should feed deer during the wintertime, particularly hay, because hay requires a different set of rumen bacteria in order to digest it than the woody vegetation that's normal. So there's a whole lot of it. We can't don't have time to go into it
right
here, but it's amazing. It is a different bacteria that is able to digest the corn than is able to digest normal woody vegetation in the winter.
All right, now let's get to his second question, which is, okay, deer were all gone. So where did they come from, and are there different kinds of white-tailed deer that maybe we could identify?
Well, there aren't different kinds so much as there are different genetics. And certainly genetics from various regions vary a lot. And over time, those genetics all get mixed together. And so in some areas, you'll tend to see deer with small antlers versus large antlers. A lot of that, though, has to do, and body size varies as well, a lot of that has to do with what's available nutritionally locally. And antler size has more to do with two things, genetics and nutrition. It has almost nothing to do with age. So bigger antlers doesn't mean it's necessarily an older animal. It means it has a different set of genetics. So, yes, there were people that brought deer into Iowa, Illinois, and other places, captive herds. And as I said earlier, some of those herds, critters from some of those herds escaped and helped repopulate both states. Now, whether those are direct descendants is highly doubtful because those genetics over time get mixed in with genetics of deer that were brought in by the agencies deliberately to try to repopulate the state. And those genetics all get mixed together. So when you see differences in antler sizes, even body sizes, yep, it reflects the genetics. But it's been long enough now and enough generations, I don't think you're going to see, you won't be able to identify and say, oh, that's an Alberta deer or that's a a Upper Peninsula deer. They're all mixed in there together. But certainly the animals reflect the genetic background.
Well, we're not going to have a lot of time to talk about how white-tailed deer live throughout the year. But let's talk about this time of year, because I think we see different behavior, of course, in white-tailed deer in the winter than we do in the summer. Why do we see so many groups of deer in the winter months?
Well, it reflects what used to happen in the wintertime, and I'm not sure that it's going to, you know, we used to have very deep snows in the wintertime, and oftentimes a deer will yard up, what's called yarding up, and we still see this in northern Minnesota, northern Wisconsin, Upper Peninsula, Michigan, where it's very difficult to get around, and you're walking on your toenails, you know, the hooved animals. You don't have a lot of surface area there to keep from slipping down in the snow, and so it is very difficult to walk through deep snow. So they tend to herd up in areas spend the winter in these deer yards. So it's a reflection of that. It's also a reflection this time of year. Fall is the breeding season for deer. And those of you who have been out driving in October and November know exactly, gee whiz, these deer don't seem to pay any attention to the cars. That's because they have breeding on their mind and nothing, not much else. And so they run across the road in front of you and several thousand of them get struck.
Clearly have not evolved to understand how automobiles work, which that's fair.
That's fair. That's fair. Absolutely. But the other thing that happens in the fall of the year, this is certainly, we've gone through early muzzleloader season in Iowa. We've gone through the two shotgun seasons. And this is now the late muzzleloader season and the last of the bow hunting season. So certainly during hunting season, their behavior changes as well. Most of the deer, or virtually all of them, have been bred by, all the does have been bred by now. And while there's still some interest in breeding, there's much lower now. And so they respond certainly to being hunted. There's no question that deer are being hunted in an area. They're not stupid at all. They're going to go, well, let's see, let's move over here. Maybe we won't get shot at. You know? So they move around in response to predation, be that by four-footed predators like wolves and mountain lions, or by two-footed predators in terms of humans. So they certainly respond to that as well.
All right, let's try to squeeze in one more caller. Mary's on the line near the Amana Colonies. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I just wanted to share some of my memories. You said the deer were gone by 1900, I believe.
Yes.
And I was born in 1933, and I never saw a deer in my life.
Wow.
As I grew up.
Wow.
Never.
That's
and
amazing.
I lived in a very desolate area. Now the DNR reports that there's we have control of the numbers. They always come out, oh, yeah, so it's well under control.
Right.
But that's not true. There's way too many deer left, and there's way too many car accidents with people hurt and killed, too much crop damage, too much hunter damage. I don't know who I dislike the most, the hunters or the deer.
All right, Mary. Well, thanks for sharing your observations and your thoughts with us. I know a lot of people feel the same way as Mary.
Yeah, it's certainly the population in Iowa has come down a lot due to very effective management over the last two decades. There were certainly a time in which car deer accidents, even as speeds increased, probably had something to do with it, and intrusion into deer habitat had something to do with it. But Iowa hunters responded and did bring the deer population down. Whether or not is at the level individuals would like to see it depends on local opinion. And very much some would like it lower, some would like to have no deer around, and I'm not one of those. I like to see deer and have them around. I think they're an important species in the state.
And beautiful.
Yeah, and beautiful to watch. So now, there are some ungulates that were probably never in Iowa. We certainly have moose is one that occasionally we see a moose wandering down from the Northland through the state. We didn't have pronghorns here, also known as pronghorn antelope. There's no evidence historically. They probably wandered in from the western states, but that was a strictly short grass prairie species, so we probably didn't have pronghorns. We never had mountain goats, and we didn't have bighorn sheep. And we haven't had caribou, not even woodland caribou, wander down in the state.
Except for maybe once a year.
Once a year, we have these presumably domesticated reindeer or caribou that visit the state once a year. And, you know, I've looked into the sort of the science behind reindeer and caribou, and I'm trying to figure out. There's an old song that says, you know, do reindeer really know how to fly? And I haven't been able to to definitively find out how they figured out how to fly, or how they do fly, because they don't have wings. It's amazing. So I come to think, you just have to believe in the magic.
All right. But thank you for your scientific perspective.
Yes, of course.
Jim Pease, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Wildlife biologist Jim Pease, he joins us every couple of months to talk about Iowa's wild creatures and our wild places as well. And I think we'll go out with a little Chuck Berry here. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Run, run, Rudolph, 'cause I'm reeling like a merry-go-round.